This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Meredith Wadman. Meredith has covered biomedical research politics for 20 years. She is a reporter at Science and has also written for Nature, Fortune, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The Wall Street Journal. A graduate of Stanford and Columbia, she began medical school at the University of British Columbia and completed her medical degree as a Rhodes Scholar at the University of Oxford. Meredith Wadman is here to tell us about her book, The Vaccine Race, Science, Politics, and the Human Costs of Defeating Disease, published in 2017. Welcome, Meredith.
Thanks for having me, Diane. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Why did you write The Vaccine Race? What is your purpose?
It really was to tell a very enticing and amazing story about a particular group of cells that were derived in the 1960s and have been used to make vaccines that have protected hundreds of millions of people from infectious diseases. And in the course of following the story of those cells, I was able to tell the story of some larger-than-life scientists who fought over the cells, who used them to make life-saving discoveries, and who really carry the story along in terms of the human interest angle.
Focusing on rubella, or the German measles, which is one of the vaccines that you talk about in your book, how widespread was the disease in the mid-20th century prior to the availability of a vaccine?
It was a regular episode in many, many children's lives. Epidemics of rubella or German measles would come around every 6 to 7 years in this country. And in 1941, an Australian eye doctor put together that about 9 months after a huge wartime epidemic in Australia, suddenly he saw a spate of blind babies in his office. His name was Norman McAllister Gregg. And he began asking why. This is unusual to see 13 blind babies in the space of 4 months. And he put out calls to his other ophthalmologist colleagues, and yes, they were seeing blind babies too. And two mothers that were waiting with their blind infants in his waiting room got to talking. They discovered that each had had rubella while she was pregnant. They came in and said to him, "Hey, is it possible that our German measles during pregnancy has anything to do with my baby's blindness?" And the penny dropped, and Norman McAllister Gregg put rubella on the map as a devastating disease if a pregnant woman is infected, particularly in the first trimester. It later became clear that not only did rubella cause blindness, cause deafness in children, caused heart defects, it caused mental disability. And so when you had the historic rubella epidemic of 1964 and 65, there were more than 20,000 babies born in this country, blind, deaf, mentally disabled, with heart defects and other problems, because the virus in a fetus infects virtually every organ. It's a scary time to be a pregnant woman, because there was no vaccine in 1964 or 65, and there was no treatment. And rubella was sometimes extremely mild, so you couldn't even tell if when you passed someone in that coffee shop or sat beside someone on the bus, whether they might have the disease or not.
Would you say more about the anguish that pregnant women who knew they had been exposed or thought they might have been exposed went through?
Yes, it was a terrible decision to make. Am I going to choose to have an abortion because my child might be damaged? What if I do and it turns out I hadn't had rubella and I aborted a perfectly healthy and much wanted infant? So it was just agonizing. There was a young pediatrician in Philadelphia named Stanley Plotkin who was determined to make a rubella vaccine. He could run a blood test that could tell a pregnant woman whether or not she had had rubella, had been infected with the virus. But it was only really good if it was taken shortly before or after she developed a rash. And some women might not even notice they had a rash. So sometimes women got to him too late, or sometimes they couldn't bear to wait the 3 or 4 weeks it took him to run that rubella test, because it was a very rudimentary and laborious test. And he, on occasion, came back to the woman and said, "I've got great news. You did not have rubella." And in some cases, it was too late. The woman had already had an abortion because she could not bear to wait any longer.
What were the effects of rubella on adults or children that were not in utero when they were exposed to it?
It's a mild disease. It's much less serious than classical measles. It's German measles, and that means that up to 2/3 of people don't know they're infected. If you're infected, you might have a rash, a fever, some swollen lymph nodes. It might not even occur to you to stay home because you might not feel that unwell. Typically, prior to the vaccine, it was young children who got rubella, and they would get it on the playground or in the nursery, and then they would bring it home to their mothers who, if they hadn't had rubella in the past and were pregnant, were in a bad situation.
What approach or approaches were used to try to develop a rubella vaccine?
Well, there were two approaches generally used to vaccine making in the early 1960s, viruses, that is, as opposed to bacteria. Viruses depend on cells to replicate. A virus outside a cell is no good. It can't eat, it can't move, it can't procreate, nothing. It has to invade a cell and hijack the cell's machinery to make umpteen thousand copies of itself and then burst out of the cell and infect other cells. So cells were used as little miniature vaccine factories. There were two approaches. You could make a bunch of virus using cells and then kill that virus with a chemical like formaldehyde, and that would be your vaccine. And that was, for instance, the Salk polio vaccine, which was the great public health victory of the late 1950s. In fact, it came online in 1955, and polio rates quickly dropped off. But you could also make a live vaccine, and that involved growing the virus in lab dish cells, and as they become more accustomed to growing in the lab, they become less good at causing disease in human beings. And so you could essentially weaken the virus by growing it in lab dish cells, and when it was sufficiently weakened, inject it as a live weakened virus vaccine. And that would cause the vaccine recipient's bodies to produce antibodies to protect the person going forward, but it wouldn't be pathologic enough to cause that disease in the person. So it was a fine balance that had to be struck. Weaken the virus enough, but not too much that it becomes ineffective as a vaccine.
Who were some of the different individuals or groups competing to develop a rubella vaccine?
Well, there was Stanley Plotkin, who was an academic scientist and pediatrician at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia. This was an elegant brownstone tucked on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania, an independent research institute run by a really fascinating, larger-than-life character named Hilary Kaprowski, who was a brilliant virologist and recruited top talent from across the country and really around the globe to staff the Wistar. Kaprowski had been a polio vaccine pioneer, and the young Stanley Plotkin, the pediatrician, had been his right-hand man trying to develop a polio vaccine. Now it was on to rubella, and Plotkin was determined to make a vaccine. How did he do it? He used some cells from a colleague who worked down the stairs and around the corner, Leonard Hayflick, another really bright, ambitious scientist. He had used cells derived from the lungs of a fetus in 1962, a fetus aborted legally in Sweden in that year. And Hayflick had grown those lung cells, which he named WI for the Wistar Institute, -38, and shown that they were normal. They did not become cancerous in lab dishes like many, many cells did back in that era. And they became the little vaccine factories that Stanley Plotkin used to grow the rubella virus to make a vaccine. How did Plotkin get that rubella virus? Well, as I mentioned, he could run the tests, tell a pregnant woman if she'd been infected with rubella. And he was inundated with these desperate parents. And when a couple or a woman, the test would come back positive and the woman decided to have an abortion, Plotkin would ask, could I use the fetal remains to try to capture the rubella virus so that I can make a vaccine? Well, in the course of the year 1964, Plotkin received 31 aborted fetuses from such parents. And of those fetuses, he captured rubella from the kidneys of the 27th fetus. That was the most hardy virus he captured, and he grew it in Len Hayflick's WI38 cells, and he developed a vaccine that he then tested in a Philadelphia orphanage which was routine back in the day to use institutionalized populations. And we can get on to that if you'd like presently. But I just wanted to circle back to your question about who were the other main players in this race to develop a rubella vaccine, because the pressure was on after 1964. It was clear that another epidemic would be expected in 6 or 7 years. The aim in Congress and throughout the population was to get a rubella vaccine before that next epidemic came around, so you wouldn't have another 20,000 damaged babies. And Merck, the drug company, and GlaxoSmithKline, but back then it was called SmithKline French, both Philadelphia area companies, were other key competitors in that race. And they used a strain of vaccine, at least one of the companies did, that was developed at the National Institutes of Health. And it was politically favored. And as a result, both the Merck and the SmithKline French vaccine, as well as another vaccine made by a Missouri company, ended up being approved in 1969 and coming to market. So at that point, there were several other vaccines than Plotkin's that were available. It looked like he had lost the rubella vaccine race, but that isn't how it ended up.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Meredith Wadman, author of the book, The Vaccine Race, Science, Politics, and the Human Costs of Defeating Disease. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. What were some of the key challenges faced in developing a rubella vaccine, in particular the concern about safety?
Well, as with any vaccine development back in that day and today, you need, with any product you're going to put in a human being, to balance risks and benefits. There is a risk associated with trying a new vaccine, and there's a benefit to protecting the person in the fact that the vaccine should protect the person from the disease in question. One of the challenges was finding children not exposed to rubella who then could be experimented on, essentially, and it could be seen if the rubella vaccine was protective. Commonly, both the drug companies and Stan Plotkin found institutionalized populations. These were orphans in a Southwest Philadelphia orphanage. They were institutionalized mentally disabled kids. In other vaccine experiments, they were premature newborns in the charity wards of the Philadelphia General Hospital. It makes shocking reading today to realize that this is what commonly went on, but it did in the two decades following World War II, and it grew out of a World War II mentality that said, the ends justify the means. We can use these populations because it's so important to get vaccines and medicines to protect our soldiers who are fighting for the survival of civilization. But when the war went away, the mentality did not, and it persisted into the mid-1960s before the first U.S. regulations that required informed consent for people to be subjects in human trials actually came online.
And I understand from your book that it was very well-known scientists as well as government institutions like the National Institutes of Health all supported this kind of testing.
They did. It was thought that it was justified because if you could quickly get a rubella vaccine by testing on some orphans or some institutionalized intellectually disabled kids, well, you could save 20,000 babies in 1970 who wouldn't be born damaged. It was like a utilitarian calculus. And it took a really important article that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1966 by a Harvard anesthesiologist named Henry Beecher to virtually reverse that tide of thinking. And what Beecher did was he published this list of 22 studies where horrible experiments had been done on people who were powerless to refuse to participate. Things like watching people with typhoid fever and treating some and not treating the others with a drug that was known to work and seeing who died faster. Well, it didn't take a rocket scientist to guess that the people who weren't treated died. And so those kinds of experiments, which had been common, were put a halt to essentially by this one man who opened his article, Henry Beecher did, by saying, I have no doubt that had the people in these experiments understood the ways in which they were being used, they would never have consented to participate. And in fact, within a month of that article being published, the U.S. government, in the person of the Surgeon General, put out a new set of requirements that research scientists needed to get the informed consent of their subjects to participate in human trials, and that groups like orphans, obviously not capable of informed consent, young toddlers and so on, and other children. And in addition, a new requirement that an ethics committee would have to pass muster on each human trial, an ethics committee that did not include the people running the trial. And so those two changes, which were codified in law in the mid-1970s, really set the stage for the system of human research protections that we have today.
What led to Plotkin's rubella vaccine produced from the WI38 cells being chosen as the vaccine used?
Well, what happened was these other three rubella vaccines were approved in 1969, and Plotkin kind of threw up his hands and, you know, was very discouraged because he had had excellent results from his tests of his own vaccine. What regulators did not count on was a woman named Dorothy Horstman, who was the first chair of pediatrics at Yale University and an expert in virology. She had been paying attention to Plotkin's work and watching the trials of his rubella vaccine. And she realized, as did Plotkin, that not only was it better at producing immunity in the people it was tried in, but it had fewer side effects than any of the three vaccines that the FDA equivalent approved for market in 1969. And so Dorothy Horstman, who was very elegant and liked to go off from Yale down to the opera in New York with fur and pearls on, also was a woman who did not take no for an answer. And she began telephoning the head of vaccine research at Merck, a sort of a god of vaccine making named Maurice Hilleman, who was sort of this profane Montanan who was a real tough guy. And the two knocked heads, and she kept calling him and saying, Plotkin's vaccine is better. Plotkin's vaccine is better. You've got to drop the one you're making and make Plotkin's vaccine. And finally, Maurice Hilleman threw up his hands and said, Dorothy, I can't repeat exactly what he said, because as I mentioned, he was a profane guy. But he basically said, okay, have your way. And Merck began trials of Plotkin's vaccine in the 70s, and it became very clear that it was the superior vaccine. And in 1979, it was approved as the R component of Merck's measles, mumps, and rubella MMR vaccine, and it remains so to this day. And it protects about, 4 million newborns born in this country every year from rubella. And not only that, it's shipped to 40 other countries around the world.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Meredith Wadman, author of the book, The Vaccine Race, Science, Politics, and the Human Costs of Defeating Disease. What were some of the issues surrounding who owns the profits from the vaccine that was made?
I have to go back on this to something I left out, which I think is really important. You'll remember Leonard Hayflick, Stan Plotkin's colleague at the Wistar Institute, who derived the WI38 fetal cells in 1962 that became the miniature factories for making the rubella vaccine and are used every year by Merck for that purpose. Where did he get those fetal cells? Well, from an aborted fetus, from the lungs of an aborted fetus. And how were those obtained? Well, the Wistar Institute's top guy, Hilary Kaprowski, had a connection with a very famous Swedish virologist named Sven Gard, who was at the Karolinska Institute, the eminent institute that awards the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. Sven Gard had been doing a sabbatical at the Wistar Institute, and when Hayflick had sort of moaned about how difficult it was to get hold of fetuses for his research, Sven Gard had said, hey, abortion's legal in Sweden. If you need a fetus from time to time, I can provide it. So in 1962, Hayflick reached out to him, and through a sympathetic Swedish gynecologist named Eva Ehrenholm, one of the few women in Swedish gynecology in the day, was able to obtain this aborted fetus. And the aborted fetus came from a woman I call in the book Mrs. X. She was in her 30s. She had several children already. She had a husband who wasn't much good. He was an alcoholic. He was often out of town for his blue-collar job. She couldn't face another child. it wasn't easy, although it was legal to get an abortion in Sweden in that era. Many, many doctors did not want to perform them. And so by the time Mrs. X found Eva Ehrenholm, the gynecologist who agreed to perform her abortion, she was 4 months pregnant. And that fetus, a girl, was taken without Mrs. X's consent, ferried to the Karolinska Institute, its lungs were dissected, packed on wet ice, and flown to Hayflick in Philadelphia. And there he developed the cells of the lungs into this self-replicating cell line. He froze 800 ampules, each with 2 to 3 million cells in it, in the summer of 1962. And these cells would divide many, many times. That's why they're still available to Merck. So who owns the cells? Well, Mrs. X was never even informed or asked her permission. She was still living in 2013. Arguably, she has a stake in the ownership of those cells. There's Hayflick, who developed them. There's the NIH, the nation's major medical research agency, which funded him to develop them. And by the way, in the small print of his contract, it said, at the end of this contract, the contractor agrees to turn over to the NIH all the materials developed on this contract. Well, Len Hayflick was very proprietary with those cells. At one point, he said to a journalist that he considered them, in quotes, like my children, unquote. They were very important cells. He had developed them. He was proud of them. And he was darned when he moved from Philadelphia to Stanford to a nice new job out in California in 1968, if he was going to leave behind all these hundreds of ampules of cells to turn over to the NIH, which asked him to do so. He was having none of it. And so even though he was instructed by NIH to turn them over, he went quietly to the basement freezers in the Wistar Institute when no one was looking. He packed them all into a portable liquid nitrogen refrigerator, which would keep them safely frozen. It looks a bit like a 100-pound bomb. It's about that size, but without the wings. He took that canister of all the cells. He strapped it into the back seat of the family Buick LeSabre alongside two of his three oldest kids. And off they drove to California via the Grand Canyon with all the cells in tow. And that led to a huge kerfuffle, a big fight with the NIH, lawsuits. Hayflick resigned from Stanford under pressure. And finally, the lawsuit settled in court, and Hayflick was allowed to keep 6 original ampules of the cells, with the rest being returned to NIH. Well, they're still owned by NIH under the stewardship of a cell repository in Manassas, Virginia, which watches over those cells 24/7 to this day. And when Merck needs a vial of them, it goes down to Manassas or has them shipped from Manassas to its facility north of Philadelphia, where it still makes the rubella vaccine.
How have concerns that the vaccine is made from a cell strain developed from an aborted fetus played out?
Well, abortion opponents got wind of this in the early 1970s, and they really protested loudly. They put out false rumors about Hayflick slaughtering babies at Stanford, which eventually he managed to have Stanford's lawyer chase down the source of these rumors and retract them. But they also protested because the cells were put on a Skylab flight for experiments on the effect of zero gravity on normal cells. But eventually the cells, their origins kind of faded from public view until the turn of this century, when a woman named Debbie Vinich, who's a very devout Catholic, realized that her grandchildren had been vaccinated with a vaccine developed in cells from this aborted fetus and began a campaign against Merck, urging it to stop developing that rubella vaccine and start from scratch, make a vaccine that doesn't depend on fetal cells. She got a shareholder resolution put before the company. It did not succeed. She wrote to the Vatican and asked Catholics in good conscience, take this rubella vaccine. The Vatican took 2 years to ponder it and eventually wrote back to her in 2005 and said, you know, it is an evil that rubella vaccine is made in these aborted fetal cells, but it is a worse evil for the community and for children not to vaccinate against rubella, given that there isn't in this country an alternative vaccine. And so that was the Vatican's word on it, and that's where it has stood till this day.
What are the lessons learned from the race to develop a rubella vaccine, ones that might be applicable to future efforts?
I think one is that science is just this incredibly flawed human enterprise The book, The Vaccine Race, is just full of these ambitious, brilliant, well-meaning sometimes and generous sometimes scientists who also do things that are not right and compromise their ethics from time to time. So I guess one of the lessons is we just always have to look at our motives and our ambitions and examine ourselves and not make people ever a means to an end, which is what was commonly done in medical research 50 years ago. And I think we can't be vigilant enough about not letting that happen today either. But I think rather than sort of train our, you know, ethical scolding on a 50-year-old practice that in a lot of ways these scientists were creatures of their time, I think we need to look at things that we're doing today that are drawing protests. To a degree, for instance, animal research and the methods used in that research, I think for a lot of people does not sit well. The way we're treating the world and the environment. I mean, there are lots of questions today that I think we would be better served to examine in terms of our own relationships and our own actions. I think it's honoring the contributions of those children, unwitting as they were, who were used in these vaccine trials, to continue to use these vaccines to further human health. It would be a terrible thing not to use them because we had some kind of protest against the 50-year-old ethics under which they were developed.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I hope you'll read The Vaccine Race. I had a ton of fun writing it. It's full of amazing people and larger-than-life characters and happenings that really are stranger than fiction. But I hope it reads like fiction because it felt like it to me as I explored it.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Meredith.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Diane.
You were just listening to Meredith Wadman, author of the book The Vaccine Race, Science, Politics, and the Human Costs of Defeating Disease, published in 2017 by Viking. For more information, check on the web at meredithwadman.com. That's MeredithWadman.com. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and on kexp.org.